investigated that talk about really expensive, super high-tech, you know, high-quality seed stock, seed bulls and prime cows being taken. Often they're described as being the best in the herd, but generally they're hybrids.
Right.
I think as a rule of thumb. And again, these are all, I bring up these, all these seemingly divergent elements to make a point, and that is that all this boils down to genetic material and blood. And contrary to what some researchers would like us to believe, that these are aliens coming to gather genetic material, I think that we should look at it conversely and look at it inversely, rather, and see that they're interested not only in a geographic region where these animals are found, but they're also interested in something to do with the actual blood of the animal. And one of the popular misconceptions about these cases is that these animals are found drained of blood and fluids. And I've only had one that I could really say that about out of almost 200 that I've seen.
Huh.
And the blood, just the gravity takes it to the lowest part of the body, and it's hidden. You don't see it down there.
Right.
You turn the animal over. And I've had, much to the shock of several ranchers, I've actually like gotten a couple guys together, and we've flopped one of these things over, and of course there's all the blood and fluids come pouring out. So
yeah,
I think it's very rare to find animals that have been completely exsanguinated of fluids. I did have one case where the blood was grayish color, pinkish maybe in some parts, but you could tell that it had been drained down almost to a capillary level. You mentioned high strange cases that I've investigated. That was one. We had a case in the 70s I didn't investigate, obviously, but where an animal's udder was filled completely with sand, so that you couldn't tell it. It wasn't, you couldn't
tell
by eye. You couldn't tell it. It had been filled with sand.
Right.
We found all sorts of chemicals and drugs in animals, ketamine, barbiturates. The National Institute of Discovery Sciences had a case where they found potassium chloride in the eye fluid, the ocular fluid, and an animal that all the copper had been removed from the blood. Now, who the heck is going out with a centrifuge out into the middle of a field, taking the blood out of an animal, spinning the copper out, and then putting the blood back in? You know, what's wrong with that picture?
Yeah, that falls off the
Del Norte, Colorado, where the animal was missing all its major organs, except for the two that predators like the best, which is the liver and the heart. Not a drop of blood was found in a pristine, fresh 5-inch snowfall. The animal's front right leg was gone, the spine was gone between the hips and the brain was sucked out of the cranium with no break into the skull.
Hmm.
The brain case was dry. There was also a smell of kind of like somebody had burnt disinfectant incense stick around it or something. It was like this very faint, but when you did smell it, it was real strong, but there wasn't many molecules of it in the air, but
right.
It smelled like disinfectant. Like walking into a room after somebody burned incense a couple of days later and occasionally getting a whiff of the incense. That's
right.
The scenario. And the animal wouldn't rot. They dragged it into a heated garage, and it was there, over a week, and it wouldn't rot.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the viscera was gone, of course, but, the major organs. So
yeah.
But still, I mean, I was there 3 days later and put my nose right next to it, and there was no smell of cadaverine coming off that thing at all, and that's highly unusual. We've had cases that were fresh, still warm, and the animals, when they tried to load them up to haul them off, fell apart like they had been in the field rotting for days.
Hmm.
So there's no rhyme or reason to much of these.
I was about to ask you that.
Many of these cases, but
I was about to ask you that. I mean,
you can't say if you've seen one, you've seen them all, because each one's different.
And that if people are wondering, I mean, when a cow just dies or it gets attacked by animals or something, it's very obvious to somebody that's a rancher that that's what happened.
Oh,
but
yeah, they tear them apart, man. It looks like a war zone.
Uh-huh.
And most, if not all, of these animals are found in a pristine condition. First thing I look for is if they've cut the hair. There's been a lathing instrument, which is rare, but most of the time it's some sort of scalpel or sharp instrument. If it cuts through the hair and you see the hair cut, you know that that wasn't an animal, because coyotes can't cut hair,
right.
Even some birds,
right,
especially in a straight line for many inches.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing I look for, is if that hide hair is cut. And if it's cut, then I know somebody did that to the animal, or something with intelligence did it to the animal. It's not the tying and gnawing and sawing action of teeth.
Uh-huh. And not one person has ever seen this happening, ever, that you know of.
Pardon me?
Has anybody ever seen this happening? Ever?
Has anyone ever
actually seen something, the cow going through this, besides the reports we hear of abductees?
Has anyone actually seen one occur?
Yeah.
You know, isn't that interesting? Yeah, there's been a few people that claim they have. Again, Linda Hout has found some people that claim aliens have been, you know, witnessed levitating animals and
mm-hmm.
Gathered around, for instance, another case, gathered around a downed animal. There was a case, interesting case from San Luis, Colorado, actually around the San Ocasio area, where a rancher who had been repeatedly hit by the third cattle experimenters saw a helicopter landed outside of his house on the road, and some human in a jumpsuit-type uniform, like, bending over, like hunched over the animal, like attaching some sort of harness or something to it. And he went inside to call the sheriff, and the sheriff came up, and by the time he went outside, the animal had been taken away. But there was a spot, like an oily spot on the road that wasn't urine, it wasn't some sort of bodily fluid, but there was some sort of like viscous oily material left behind. And he did end up missing a cow that night, if my memory serves me correct, and then always equated that missing cow with that helicopter parked out
right
on the road, you know, fairly close to his house. And I guess actually he wasn't the one that even saw it. It was some people driving down the road who were blocked by the animal on the road and the helicopter, who turned around and went an alternate way and reported it to the sheriff because of all the cases that have been reported in the area. And the sheriff raced out there in a matter of minutes and again, found just that viscous material on the road, which was, to my knowledge, never analyzed or anything. Animals have been seen slung underneath helicopters in some sort of harness apparatus.
Oh, so people have seen this.
Pardon me?
So this has been seen a few times.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's pretty rare. I only know of a couple, three cases, maybe only a couple, where actual slings, animals in slings have been seen. And again, these are the exceptions rather than the norm. I mean, for every
right
one of these types of cases, there's hundreds that, you know, just show up the next morning or several days later or whatever is being cut up.
And sometimes right next to the
no
person's
clue or no evidence whatsoever.
Yeah, and sometimes right next to the person's place, to their house.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was one case where there's no trees for several miles around the house. And the animal was out in the field, and when they woke up, it was 30 feet from the front door in their yard.
Hmm.
Dogs are there, voracious watchdogs, never barked.
Amazing. Being out there for so long, you must have had all kinds of people come out there and visit. And I know you've been on some TV shows and things like that. You did tell me an interesting story, a pretty funny one, about that weird weekend British show.
Oh, Louis Theroux and his weird weekend crew, yeah.
Yeah, they came out and with their whatever upper-class British upbringing, who probably eat meat and all that, they suddenly saw a mutilated cow, and they were hanging around it and freaking
yeah, it was
out.
Funny.
Yeah, and then
they came out to ambush me for a humorous program. They go around and poke fun at people. He has a show in England called Weird Weekends. And, you know, he on this particular show, I think there was four segments, he went to visit the militia group that's all dressed up in their, you know, uniforms waiting to provide security and be body guards for aliens when they finally you know, land on the White House lawn or whatever.
Where are those guys?
I don't know. They're out in Vegas somewhere.
Wow.
Then there was the two competing, the what's his name, Cobb, or the guys in Roswell that each claim they have the Roswell site, and they compete for tourist dollars.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right. The ones
and
up
there
northwest.
Was another, I think the guy that sells alien insurance or some other cockamamie person they went and visited, and then they came, and then I was included in this. And when they came out, they tried to set me up for all these Daily Show style ambush bits, you know, humorous bits, and I just wouldn't play along. And so they never got anything they could use. And when they, you know, they hung around and finally got a little frustrated after a few days, and they said, "Well, we're going to go out and cover this other story in Vegas. So we're going to be still in the U.S. for a couple weeks. So if something happens, let us know, and we'll come back out." And sure enough, I had a real case that occurred just before they left. the U.S., and they came out, and they kind of threw me off my stride. They filmed my entire investigation, all the plant and soil sample taking, complete forensic samples that I took from the incisional areas. And normally I videotape, and I didn't hit record or something, so I wasn't able to get tape on this thing. So I complained to them when they went back, and they sent me all their B-roll, which is an hour plus, two beta tapes worth of footage of all the outtakes and everything. And you know, there's gas bubbles, you know, blowing these big bubbles out the cow's rectum, and just their response to all this stuff was just hysterical. I mean, at one point the ranch's dog started licking the blood out of the eye socket that had been, you know, carved out. And the guy's, oh my God, the dog is licking the blood from the eye socket of a mutilated cow. This image will stay in my mind forever. Oh, how can you do this? Oh my God. It was so funny. So I took the entire, I made a transcript of all the banter at this mutilation site and published it in my second book. I turned the whole thing around on them. When they sent me the segment of the show, I came out like a serious, you know, investigator cracking jokes to these guys that are like green colored because they're so grossed out by the whole thing.
Right.
It was actually quite funny, but in a real kind of serious sort of way, you know.
Uh-huh.
You have to kind of armor yourself from, you know, the spookier side of this whole realm. And I've come up with some interesting ways to try to make it as light and not so unpleasant as possible. And, of course, humor is always a good way to break the tension. And so I was cracking quite a number of jokes at their expense, especially when he puked into his hand and, like, kind of like, oh, it was pretty gross. Anyway.
It was more gross than the cow mutilation.
I got my comeuppance. Of course, it took me 3 months to get the BBC to send me back the release form so I could legally use it.
Yeah.
And I did have to take a couple of spicy words out.
Well, yeah, of course. You also told me that the guy who wrote Hunt for Zero Point, Nick Cook, came out there at one point, and he was doing a show on secret aircraft.
Right.
And,
yeah, Billion Dollar Secret. If you ever see it, they broadcast on TNT, I think, from time to time. Very well done.
And he came out thinking he would find one thing and yet discovered far more than he thought he would, and you said he actually got kind of freaked out about it.
Yeah. He admits during the documentary, I'm about, you know, three-quarters of the way through it, he admits that they thought they'd had it all figured out, and then they went and visited me in Colorado, and they weren't so sure. Privately, he did admit to me that there was definitely something going on, and he was not really prepared for the quality of witnesses and the quality of the data that I was able to turn him on to when he came out. And
why did he come out?
The program, a very good job of journalism.
Why did he come out and visit you with regards to secret aircraft? Because of the stuff that's flying
around?
Well,
because of the proximity of the military operations area, which is just over the mountains from us, and we're right on a visual training route. For the, called the La Vida Military Operations Area. It's a low-flight training area, and, of course, they do trot out stuff from the front range and fly it through. And so he heard about all the activity, conventional and otherwise, in the area. And, of course, he wanted to, he had his fact finders come out and interview me, and then felt that there was enough, compelling information for him to actually bring the crew out and do some filming. They filmed all in film, too. It wasn't video, so it was quite an elaborate,
right.
Painstaking process. Film, of course, is a lot more difficult to to shoot than video. And we do see a lot of very strange, possibly conventional, unconventional conventional aircraft that are probably black budget projects that are being tested. I've often joked with people that, they stopped flying in Area 51 years ago. Now they're in Area 52, which is the San Luis Valley. It's pretty close proximity to Kirtland, to Holloman, to the five Air Force bases on the Front Range, Shriver, Lowry, Falcon, Buckley, all the Air Force bases out in the Front Range. We're 10 minutes away,
It's funny that these bases are all it is pretty far out there.
I
was just thinking, it's funny all these bases are surrounding this area and flying through there. They have to see a few things when they're flying around there, too. And I think you described in your book jets chasing some of these weird lights around the valley.
I actually saw them. One of my first sightings was two huge, probably small house-sized glittering orange balls that were flying at fairly low altitude, one after another, down the entire length of the valley. And I had a, you know, I was up about 300 feet off the valley floor, so I had an unencumbered view from almost, you know, 250 miles I could see from my house, and especially up from my roof. And I saw these two balls of light zip down the valley, completely silent, going at hypersonic speed. And
was this at night?
Yeah, and then 8 minutes later, coming from the east over the range with afterburners on, air in full combat power. I mean, those the jet exhaust, the flames were coming 30 feet out, you know, behind the craft. I mean, they were hauling ass, and they came screaming over the mountains and then did these bank turns. And one of the objects had gone southwest, the other object had gone south, and they both split up right where the objects did. And one guy took off after one, and the other guy took off after the other one. Of course, this was about 7 or 8 minutes after they had gone by, but. But boy, you could tell they'd been scrambled somehow, and had, you know, the chop controllers had been alerted, and they scrambled these guys. And one thing about the San Luis Valley, it's radar invisible below 18,000 feet because of all the mountains that surround it. So it's a perfect little testing ground out of sight, you know, from prying radar, and you know, and in a rural environment where people are pretty superstitious and don't really want to know what's flying around, or they're so conditioned and used to it that it's not a big deal. I think it's even more accurate. So, yeah, the government definitely, you know, trots this stuff out. I mean, look how many sightings of the F-117 stealth that probably were reported in the, you know, in the 80s, but prior to its public, you know, unveiling, that were, I mean, God, if I saw a stealth back in the early 80s, I would have thought I saw a UFO.
Yeah, especially if you're
in a car and couldn't hear it.
Yeah, know? Especially if you're looking at it from, you know, in front or behind or from the side. It looks exactly like that. In fact, Nick Cook, I actually had a slight discussion with him. I said that Paul Benowitz, when he went up to Dulce and flew around there, I think he saw a crashed test F-117 in the late 80s, and they tried to lead him away from that, and a guy from Lockheed actually started disinforming him about it. And Lockheed is of course the contractor that made the stealth. So and his drawings sort of look like.
You're gonna have to talk into that phone a little better because you're fading out on me again.
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
He had done these drawings of something he saw crash up near Dulce, and this guy who was an NSA guy connected with the stealth program at Lockheed started writing him letters and telling him, yeah, it was an alien craft, and long enough for him to, and told it was full of radiation and, you know, he shouldn't go up there, and long enough for him to, somebody to get out there and clean the thing up.
Clean up after him.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we had the NORAD case, which was January 12th, 94, which found NORAD calling the Rio Grande County Sheriff to report to them a significant heat event that occurred, you know, particular coordinates, and a retired SAC fighter pilot about 100 miles away saw a whole squadron, a battalion of these glowing green orbs descend right. He projected it on raced home, grabbed an aeronautic map, and then traced their path right directly, unbeknownst to him at the time, right where NORAD had reported this heat bloom. And I thought, man, that was pretty intense that NORAD would call up and report what later turned out to be potentially a large flight of a group of grouping of UFOs, and that was quite a newsworthy story. I've done quite a number of TV segments and wrote a couple articles, and it was quite a news story. I thought I called it the Dark Horse UFO event of '94 in the United States because, you know, NORAD's involvement, and there were some rumors of people being suicided who were involved in the initial monitoring and contact with the sheriff. There were some weird deaths supposedly that occurred on the front range in the military, which I was never able to confirm, but I got some corroborated from a couple of sources that, yeah, people, you know, involved in the initial Homer Simpson moment there, calling the sheriff and reporting what, you know, either with some sort of secret military activity or something high strange. You know, I just find it interesting that you then get these strange stories of people involved dying, you know, which invariably happens from time to time in this realm. But
yeah,
that was quite an interesting event, which does, you know, I mean, one of the co-designers of the DSP spy satellite, the bird that actually detected this heat bloom, I know now as a result of my investigation and research in that case, I've become quite friendly with. And, he said, well, they sure as heck knew that something happened. And he went and checked, and sure enough, they did have a significant event that did not conform. They thought maybe it was a propane tank at a house that had exploded or some sort of airline crash or plane crash. And, of course, the Sheriff's Department of Search and Rescue looked for 3 days, didn't find a thing. But, there are rumors all through the community there in the following days of convoys and, flatbed big trucks with tarps on them and temporary fences that were found up in the mountains and just strange activity. B-52s doing super low passes over the area with strange antennas and possibly EWAC-type retrofitted B-52s that were brought into...
Did anybody ever go? Did anybody go out there after the fact to see if there was anything, any kind of evidence?
Oh yeah, they combed the whole area. And
no, I mean somebody that wasn't military.
Yeah, the sheriff and all his guys did, and I spent a good deal of time tramping around up there. But
is that where you found that? Is that where that was? There was some.
It's real difficult to cover the amount of ground because the initial coordinates that they gave were not the coordinates that the sheriff ended up searching, because they immediately called back and said, we were wrong, it was at these coordinates, and
exactly,
which were 20 miles off. So they exhausted all their efforts 20 miles away from the initial event. Of course, they went in and swooped up whatever it was. Some people speculated that they were firing rockets from White Sands and landing them in Utah, just below Green River, Utah. Which has been touted as a potential Area 51 type spot.
That's not the first time that
it crashed halfway there or something. And,
right.
And so there was some sort of retrieval of that. But it doesn't conform to NORAD's involvement, nor does it conform to the type of military activity that was reported by locals there.
Yeah. It's not the first time in history that something has crashed and they take investigators as civilians and lead them, 20, 30 miles away to some other area to give them time. This happened near Bakersfield, I think, in the late
80s.
Right,
they do nothing to try to, downplay any sort of ufological potential because it's plausible deniability for them.
Yeah. Well, they actually tell UFO investigators, in this case, they told them to go look in this certain area that was about 14 miles away from the actual crash site of the...
Right. Well, they told law enforcement this. If it had been investigators, you could almost, understand that. But these were cops, man, spending... county funds with search and rescue personnel and planes and, big groups of people combing the countryside in very rough terrain on the mountainside.
Yeah, it's difficult for some. Well, it's in pop culture. It's intimately connected, UFOs and cattle mutilations. But when you went into this in the early 90s, did you have a certain idea of what the UFO subject was or what it might be caused by or anything like that? And did that change over the years as you did these investigations?
Yeah, well, like everybody else, who's got a more than passing interest in this subject area, you tend to read all the books and absorb all the particular theories and conjecture, and you're left with this morass that really doesn't provide you with any real, solid, concrete answers. And so you tend to just slowly be... layer upon layer of pop culture sort of programming. Of course, I went into this thinking, oh my God, these UFOs are aliens from another planet. I'd read all my Valet, I'd read all my Keel, the contrarians in ufology who say that this is all, potentially closed system stuff, that these entities or forces are
very
are
earthly
part of this planet, this closed system.
Yeah.
And of course I'd read all those, but of course you just get hypnotized by this pop culture programming. And so, I saw Close Encounters, I saw, read the Roswell book and Travis's, book, and you just sort of go into it just assuming, well, yeah, of course, it's aliens. But the more I researched and the more I really got into it, the less likely that explanation to me seemed. And my thinking has really gone 180 on that. I'm very, very much in the side of the Valet and Keel sort of view that we are dealing with a closed system phenomenon that's living here with us somehow, whether it's in this dimension or some others, this particular dimensional realm or maybe some higher dimensional realm that has access to these three dimensions plus time.
Mm-hmm.
And And so I think that it's anthropomorphic of us to consider ourselves to be important enough for these little gray aliens to be going around collecting rock samples and doing medieval medical experiments that don't even conform to the level of technology that humans have. They could stick something in orbit around this planet the size of a beer keg and find out everything they wanted to know about it just using the level of technology that we have. And it's just something doesn't ring true about beings coming light years, you know, thousands of millions of miles or light years away to do these ridiculous experiments and exhibit, you know, very strange sort of nonsensical metallogical behavior. And
right.
I'm just of the mind to think that we're not important enough for a spacefaring culture to come here. And if when they do come here, which they may have, and I could be wrong, and these could be aliens, I would think that it would be a big deal when they got here. It would be like childhood end. They'd park something over a ship over every city for a couple of generations till we got used to them and then it'd reveal themselves. I mean, I would tend to fall into the Sagan sort of Sitchin category when it comes to potential, involvement from off-planet. My sense is that we are dealing with something that's as terrestrial as we are. It just has how do we know that they're not evolved dinosaurs?
Yeah.
You know, that have chosen to go live underground or maybe have become spacefaring and are coming back to reclaim the planet. How do we know that? We don't. I mean, mankind, or humans in a million years have gone to the moon. Dinosaurs were around for,
yeah,
you know, 160 million years. They could have ebbed and flowed and become highly technological and advanced three or four times.
Yeah, well, here's one that stumps me. Why such an insistence on grays? And that only came out in the probably Barney and Betty Hill, but became vogue in the late 70s because every government document describes, you know, they describe human-like ones, but they also describe, you know, gray-skinned beings with big heads and big eyes, and that seems to be the norm now. All these government documents that have come out, whether you trust them or not, say they're from another planet. Well, that's maybe all they knew. They're from another planet, and everybody that's being abducted sees the same thing. And, you know, I've got certain things I put that down to, but what do you think? What do you think about the gray idea and why it's only been around for a while?
Well, you mentioned earlier that isn't it interesting that in South America they were seeing small, hairy dwarves, and,
mm-hmm.
and I mentioned, you know, a whole flurry and string of large robotic forms that were reported in Russia.
Yeah.
And for many years, even after Americans started, you know, developing this cultural meme of the little gray alien, there seemed to be a lag time. Then all of a sudden these gray aliens started popping up in other continents. And then now that's a predominant form that you hear about. It's almost like the phenomenon is supplying us with a detail appearance that we are almost programmed to be ready for, be conditioned to see or to experience, and it's almost like living up to our collective expectation. And to me, that is another indicator that we're dealing with a cultural sort of shading here, and that the popularity in the media of the gray alien archetype has become so strong that it's actually chased away the other types of archetypes in South America and Africa and in, you know, China and other places where you now have reports of gray aliens where you never did 30 years ago, 40 years ago. You never heard of these types of descriptions from other continents.
Yeah.
It was only, you know, when the popularization and the pop culture programming kicked into full gear, and like you said, the late 70s and through the 80s with Whitley Strieber's books and Close Encounters and, you know, the whole Roswell descriptions of the entity body supposedly in Roswell, then that's when you really had that archetype get jump-started into awareness, collective awareness. And I think that's another clue for us all who are interested in the subject to look at the patterning of entity types and how they've been reported down through the ages. I mean, you know, incubus and succubus are interchangeable to nighttime abductions in many people's estimation, and genies and goblins and trolls and brownies and leprechauns and all these types of elemental forms that have been reported for 1,000+ years I think, are tied directly into the ufological equation. Jacques Vallée's book, Passage to Magonia, is a must-read for anybody who's interested in this potential connection. And I just find it very interesting that that these entities tend to couch themselves in a level of technology just before, just ahead of the time that they're perceived in. And now, since we're a technological race, we're seeing beings that are exhibiting levels of technology just slightly ahead of ours. And, you know, the great airship wave in the 1890s, same thing. This is just before the, you know, the rigid airships, the Zeppelins, started flying around. But just prior to that, in the 1896 and 97, there was an amazing wave across 30 states of these airship sightings and interactions with the pilots.
Right.
But the pilots would do things like ask people what time it is and then tell them they were lying and that wasn't the right time.
Right.
Or when someone asked them, well, you know, who are you and where are you going? They say, well, it's going to rain today or it's going to rain tomorrow in Spain. Or they come up with these nonsensical, absurd answers.
Yeah,
we're from
Canada.
Witnesses would have for them when they find them on
we'll
the ground
in,
with this huge ship and they'd be tinkering with it.
We'll be in Cuba tomorrow.
Huge steam pistons clanking on them and all this, you know, sort of Victorian era industrialized technology.
Right, exactly.
And I just think that it's very apparent to me that we're dealing with something that is masquerading as something else, at the very least, and is trying to conform to a collective view of what they should appear to be, and the types of, you know, scientific capabilities that their technology apparently has. Tends to be just ahead of where we are now as a race, as a technological race. So, you know, I don't know. Go figure.
All right. Well, maybe a couple hundred years ahead anyway, with respect to, you know, coming from other planets. There's a very interesting paper that came out recently by co-authored by about four people, two of which are Hal Puthoff and Bruce McAdoo.
Okay, I totally lost you again.
I'm
sorry.
There's an interesting paper that came out recently. It's going to be published in the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society, authored by about four different people, at least three of whom are actual scientists. Hal Puthoff is one of them, and Bruce McAdoo. And they take the idea that, according to theoretical physics, it's quite possible for somebody from another planet to come here because the distance wouldn't make any difference.
Right.
That's just one, you know, one idea. They actually, you know, pumped a scientific edge into the extraterrestrial hypothesis. But to me, that doesn't mean that's all it is, because there's so many weird things that, you've just been mentioning.
Yeah, I think most groups myself, regardless of where they're from or what their agenda is, they're not all. I mean, I've had reports of UFOs and dogfights in the Sandwich Valley, actually chasing each other and shooting at each other with strange, you know, weaponry.
Really?
Oh, yeah. In cases of Air Force jets firing at objects, and even one case where the witnesses claimed they heard the cannon fire hitting the craft. They could hear the smack of the metal on metal. Go figure. You know,
well, why?
One was the head of the EMTs in a pretty sizable town. I mean, not just some, you know, local drunk or something. I mean, we're talking, you know, trained observer, someone that's, you know, tops in their field.
Uh huh.
So, you know, again, there's, and if you look through the annals carefully of ufology, you'll find very interesting cases where certain types of objects tend to be in conflict with other discernible, distinct types of objects. And Ray Stanford mentioned this to me at one point, where he has a whole string of cases where these things, very identifiable types of objects, are in conflict with very identifiable different types. And these range, these events range, you know, through a fairly tight period of time, a matter of a couple of years, I think, but widely dispersed in terms of where the events took place. So it's not like they saw the same type of event occur in the same place. These were very similar events that were recorded widely separated from one another over a matter of time. So
when was this?
You know, I'd have to check my notes with Ray, but I think this is in the mid to late 70s, if I remember correctly.
I'm just trying to think of some idea why people would be seeing UFOs fighting with each other. I've never heard of that type of report, ever.
Oh, well, I've got several in my sighting log that I personally investigated, yeah. I have reports of Air Force jets accompanying big triangular craft. This was given to me by a deputy of a sheriff's department.
Yeah.
And then another case where a similar event took place. A retired sheriff of the county was out raking his lawn or doing some garden work or something, and looked up and saw this big black object that was surrounded by planes. And somebody started to drive up his driveway, and he looked down to see who it was and looked back up, and they were all gone. So I've seen what looked like to be a C-131 that hadn't been painted. It was bright aluminum color. It looked like it was brand new. And I was looking at it with binoculars, and the thing blinked out in a perfectly blue sky with not a cloud in the sky, and it was right above me. And I had, really 50-power binoculars on it.
Yeah.
And so who knows? I mean, there's just – I think the technological connection between our military-industrial complex and those who have control over it and actualize these advances technologically, I think there's a lot that's involved that we don't know about just in terms of our capabilities as a technological, humans. Our capabilities may be somehow tied into, knowledge that we've gained from whatever types of craft these are, their capabilities. And I think we may be harnessing certain portal areas like the San Luis Valley. I think that there's many reports that I've had of jets disappearing into mountains, of objects flying directly into mountains. People clear as day see them, not once, not twice, but many times. There does seem to be, a connection there. These little scout ships that were reported for many years zipping around the valley that I even saw one in 92 were reported disappearing into Middle Creek Hill, which is part of the Sangres, the foothill of the Sangres. And,
right.
You think one, two people see it, yeah, that's cool, and then you interview three or four or five or six, and then it just gets ridiculous. It's like, how can everybody be seeing the same thing and not take them all seriously,
My friend of mine here in the Air Force, one of them said that his one of his relatives in the 50s was trained to fly helicopters in caves.
Wow.
That was part of his training. They would fly into these caves in Arizona and New Mexico, and they were big enough for them to fly around with no problem.
Wow. Yeah, there's a story that the Rio Grande Gorge has some, doorway that opens up, and this like concrete pad comes out, and there's a helicopter sitting on it, and the helicopter will fly off, the thing will go back into the mountain, and the doors will close.
Yeah. Oh, this is that area you're talking about is just northwest of Taos, right?
Yeah.
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 Because I've been in that area.
Yeah, I've had stories like that. Yeah.
I've been in that area. I've gone to the hot springs there. I've been over that big bridge that's right outside of Taos. Yeah, it's
huge.
Well,
Cal Levesque was the one that mentioned that. He actually claimed that he saw one of these choppers take off from a pad that was extended out from the side of the Rio Grande Gorge after these huge doors opened.
Uh-huh.
And that's a whole other subject that we could spend a lot of time on, is the extent of our government's involvement in constructing underground facilities. There's quite a number of them in the on the Colorado New Mexico border.
Yeah,
Dulce is just one of a number of them.
Well, if there is one there, you think there's a base there?
I don't think there's a base. There's a weapons storage facility there. From the best of my knowledge, I've been able to identify and talk with one gentleman who was helped build it.
What was his name? Schneider.
No.
That was the guy who said
Bill
he had...
Schneider? No.
Yeah, he said he had been
No, this
worked
is a little
the...
old Spanish miner who was deaf from blasting dynamite underground for 30 years.
Oh, okay.
No, this is the real deal. He helped build some of the Los Alamos facility. His son was worked at the lab out there at Los Alamos for quite a number of years, and that's how he kind of got turned on to this guy. And he also claimed they stumbled into an antediluvian tunnel system that had been there for thousands and thousands of years, because they could tell from the mineralization, the stalactites and stuff that had grown since it had been carved, and perfectly carved out out of hard rock a big tunnel system that they broke into when they were expanding the lab. And of course he was told not to say anything about it.
Yeah, well, here's a whole area that people that has been kind of ignored, is that these extensive tunnel systems, irrespective of the underground facilities being built now, but these things are all over the world. There was that
one. Yeah, well, if anybody's interested in that subject, there's one book to get. That's Underground Bases and Tunnels, What is the Government Trying to Hide? And
yes, Richard Sauter's book.
Richard Sauter is the preeminent expert on that. And I'll tell you, you read that book, you walk away from the table realizing out of 129 known huge facilities that are underground that are publicly known about, he couldn't find one penny of funding that could explain the where the money came from to build them all. He combed through many appropriations bills over the years to try to find funding for these facilities and has never been able to find a penny. So, you know, that's 129 facilities that we know about. Most of those, of course, are continuation of government facilities in West Virginia and Pennsylvania.
Right, exactly.
Other underground facilities in the Midwest and other places. Of course, you know, the famous ones, facilities roughly like Yucca Mountain in Nevada, and of course the famous Cheyenne Mountain, the NORAD facility there. And
Manzana, but, nuclear storage.
Where's all the money coming to build these things? I mean, the Pentagon claims that it's missing $1.1 trillion, so that's $100,000, you know, million-dollar bills.
Yeah.
You know, so if my math is correct, I kind of get lost when I get up there in the big zero range there. But, I really have a strong sense that there's a connection to things subterranean. Whether that's a valid connection or not, I don't know. There's many myths and legends from all around the world pertaining to reptilian forms underneath our feet. So Tibetans call them the Nagas. You know, Palula Kang is the Hopi version. There's Ultima Thule.
Shangri-La,
you have to go underground to get to it.
Yeah, many of the southwestern tribes, that's where people emerged from, and that's where they go to when they die. And supposedly,
the Native Americans feel they emerged into this current world through a hole in the ground. The Hopi say it's the Grand Canyon. Most of the other southwestern Indians claim it's in the San Luis Valley, in the San Luis Lakes area, possibly. That's another element of the Native American thing that we didn't cover, is that the Sapapu is a place of emergence for the South Pueblo, and other southwestern Indians is considered to be the San Luis Valley there. Some say it's up on Blanca, Lake Wynn, this lake up there. Others say it's down in the valley by the Great Sand Dunes. And there's another version that says, the Jicarillas say it's just over La Vida Pass by Silver Mountain. But it's all basically in the same 25-square-mile area that they're describing this place of emergence. Of course, the Hopi have to be different and say they emerged in the Grand Canyon. But, of course, when they go back underground, guess where they go? They go to the San Luis Valley. So they end up there.
I thought it was supposed to be under a lake that's they have to make a pilgrimage to once in their life. That's kind of, they call it the Salt Lake. I think it's south of the.
You're gonna have to bring it up a notch here.
Sorry, they said that. I thought the Hopi said they have to go to some lake they call, I think, the Salt Lake, that's south of the Hopi reservation. No, that was Zuni. I'm sorry, that was the Zuni tribe.
Yeah, the Zuni are interesting. They have kind of a separate. Their traditions are, again, a little iconoclastic compared to the others. Again, most of these cultures are offshoots in one way, shape, or form or another. The Rio Grande Pueblos are all offshoots probably of the Anasazi, and so they all have similar beliefs, the Zuni being the exception.
Hopi,
of course.
Well, you know, Chris, we're at the 10 o'clock hour here. And we didn't get into another 10 or 12 things that we wanted to talk about.
Oh, well. Have to keep having me back, man. If people keep downloading it and want to know more, you know.
Yeah, there's a good deal of people listening, especially for this show. And like I said, I do get quite a bit of downloads on these shows.
Great. Well, let me give my email address out.
Oh, yeah, please do.
My website for anybody who's interested. I have my own domain. It's TMV, the Mysterious Valley abbreviation, T as in Tom, M as Mary, V as in Victor, .us. Yes, the United States has its own country code extension, so I'm TMV.us, and if you want to contact me by email, it's my initials, Chris O'Brien, C-O-B, at TMV.us. So my website's about 50 megs. It's got quite a bit of material, lots of pictures. There's some really interesting aerial phenomena in there, cattle death cases, guest editorials, a sighting log, all kinds of goodies on there. And, there's even a section where you could buy my book. So, whatever. Have your way with it.
The two books are The Mysterious Valley and Enter the Valley. And then I guess there's another one coming up in the next year or so. That's the project with – is that the project with Ray Stanford, or is that something else?
Which now?
You said you had another book or books coming up.
Yeah, I'm working on the third book, which tentatively is the working title is The Magical Valley or Magical Valley, which will get into a lot of the areas that I touched on. The first two books, cultural stuff, ritual crime.
Oh, okay.
The ritual element to all this, brujas, brujos, sorcerers, curanderas, healers, religious miracles. More in-depth stuff of similar things that I've covered in the first two books, but also more Native American information.
All right.
And I'm also writing a book called Stalking the Herd, which I hope to to release and have it be the textbook for the Calvin Relation phenomenon. Nobody's written it yet, so... An alien harvest was one side of the of the the coin. I'm trying to be as objective as possible and not jump into any particular theory or foregone conclusion, but look at man and humans' relationship with cattle and how it might be exemplified in this day and age. Now that we're into the very real potential of mad cow disease affecting the human food chain. So,
right.
Stock of the Herd, hopefully I'll get a book deal on that. Any book publishers out there listening, give me a call, email me. I'd love to talk turkey with you. We need to get this book out.
Yeah.
And I'm all done with a book on Ray Stanford, who we probably should spend 2 hours talking about just... or we'll get Ray on the show.
Oh, that'd be great.
Freeway.
That would be great.
I'll help you interview Ray Stanford. Boy, I'll tell you, talk about a guy that deserves to be heard. He's the... head and shoulders above anybody else in ufology. In my,
I don't think
my
he's talked publicly in probably 20 or 30 years, at least on the radio.
He's what?
I don't think he's talked publicly, at least on a radio show, in probably 20 or 30 years or something.
He's been on one or two, but
really?
Yeah, I think generally he's really been keeping a really super low profile since the mid-70s. He's really shy and retiring and is doing a lot of really good work.
All right. Well, I know a lot of people that will want to hear from Ray, so we'll try to get him on either next time or at some point in the near future.
Okay.
Okay. We've been talking with Chris O'Brien here, author of The Mysterious Valley and Enter the Valley. You can reach his website at tmv.us, and your email was cob@tmv.us, right?
Correct.
And we'll be back next week, probably maybe with an interview, maybe with music. But we always like having Chris on, and I will put this interview up on radioforall.net
yes,
within the
next
week or so.
Yes, please do alert me when you do that so I can go get a download copy of it. I'd
all right.
Be appreciative.
Okay, Chris.
Great, Greg. Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks so
nice
much.
Being on the show, and hello to everybody. And hey, keep your eyes to the sky, but more importantly, keep your ears to the ground, folks.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye. Wow, that was fun. Well, I hope you enjoyed it, and I've run over my time a bit. The next show isn't here, but we'll put some music on for a little bit here and then probably put in a file of either one of my old shows or something else. Any last-minute calls? I can't get
you
calls.
You have $15.
No, I don't.
$60.
There we go. I'm glad I have $15.60 left. What was I saying? Any last-minute calls, 213-252-0998. We'll be here for a few minutes. And, I can't take calls when I'm doing an interview because we only have one phone line. It's killradio.org, and it's Radio Mysterioso. Here's Sheldon Allman with something I have played before. Hope I don't blast your ears out here.
She's the girl from the fourth dimension. We met once, as I recall. I gave her my close attention when she came walking through my wall. She is the girl from the fourth dimension. One kiss and my toes were curled. Our affair was too brief to mention, for she lived in another. and breadth, but that is all. She had something extra, extra dimensional. Now she's back in the fourth dimension. It's better this way, you see, 'cause I only have three dimensions. She could never be happy with me. She could never be happy with me.
You